pretty certain Joe Hart has those tattoos that are like...
Yeah, the two black stripes.
The fisting tattoos.
Is that what it is?
I know...
As in, it's a gauge?
I believe that is...
Fuck off.
The common understanding, yeah.
Yeah, I know quite a few people who have similar ones.
Yeah, because it's kind of like a I went to Bali type tattoo right?
I find myself tattoo.
But it's also, you found yourself up somebody else's ass.
You find yourself elbow deep. His are quite high up as well. His are like up here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's no point doing it if you're like, it's just like, it's halfway down the hand.
Yeah, yeah. It's basically fingering at that point.
Imagine if you just did it like on like the first knuckle and you were like, that's my limit. Yeah. This is an amazing way to come into the podcast. I think we should just leave this in, cold open. But, you know, it is time for the podcast. And this week we're going to be talking about whether some of the big transfers of the summer are worth the prices they're being touted at. Then we'll open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we're doing some other stuff. What are we doing on the paid side? Oh, we're picking players for our teams this summer. Pete's picking two players for Man United. I'm picking two players for Arsenal. And then we've got a listener question. Thank you to Josh Davis for your contribution. Okay, so before we get started, I do want to thank Josh Davis because basically I said if people want to have a question answered, like please do donate to my fundraising campaign. To be clear, that's not like money for me. That is money going to a good cause. It's going to community projects in India. It's also going to the Dove House Hospice in Hull. My parents have had friends die in that hospice. My dad, as a vicar, used to take communion to people in that hospice. Like, it's like an important community artifact. And hospices are actually really important. Like, when you're in healthcare, right? Like, healthcare is basically, can we get you better? But at a certain point, the healthcare kind of system is like, well, no, we can't get you better. And that is when organizations like hospices step in to make sure that people have good quality of life as they are approaching death, and then that the families are supported. So that is what the Dove House Hospice is. So if you would like me to answer a question, even not here, just like on Instagram or something, like, or on Twitter, like, get at me, donate what you can. I'd really appreciate it, and it goes to a really good cause. Okay, Pete, how Patrick. Are you? It's good to see you, man.
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I always think when you wear this green shirt that it's kind of like fashion scout leader. I've got one quite similar, you know, like a short sleeve. Yeah. Though yours has a more interesting collar, which I think makes it, like, I've gone off mine because I find it was like, you know, the first stage you go through when you start getting into clothes, there's a bunch of stuff you buy and you love it. And then 3 years later, you're like, this does nothing for me now. You know, this is like too missionary for me. I need something more like, you know, Amazon position. which I think who invented that? I feel like that's a Zoomer invention. I don't think that people were doing the Amazon position on the internet when we were 18.
Surely it existed pre us.
I'm sure. No, I'm not arguing that it didn't exist. I'm just saying that, like,
well, it was popularized by Zoomer.
I think it's more mainstream. You know, like, it's like the you know, but, pegging, for example.
But
like,
also,
pegging's been around for a long time. But at the same time, pegging is pegging's hot right now.
I think it's just access, though. I think we grew up with analog. We grew up with magazines and top shelf, you know, content that was literally on the top shelf. Whereas these other generations grew up with it just readily available on the internet. And I think being exposed in that way, having it also readily available, means that you exhaust the vanilla stuff much quicker. I think
that's possibly true.
It stretched out much longer. You know, all of the Page Three era for us stretched out way longer than the current generations who are just going, you know, pretty early in with pegging and Amazon positions.
Yeah, that's true. The idea of being able to see, like, one tit where, you know, like, they're artfully holding a towel over the other tit. Like, you were like, this shit is insane. And now kids are just like, how deep can Joe Hart get his arm in me?
Well, yeah, we grew up with dial-up internet that would load pictures in stages. You would see blocks
from
of
the
pictures.
Top down as well.
Yeah.
Cursed. Like, do it from the bottom up at least.
You would see blocks of pictures come on screen, and it would take like literally 30 plus seconds per. This is, I don't know why.
This is amazing. I love talking about like manual. Masturbation, basically.
Analog content. Yeah. So one of my pet peeves is I think actually you've spoken about it in the Burnbrook, is when technology doesn't work. Or no, it was the Severn stuff. When technology doesn't work as efficiently or as quickly as it should. So loading screens, things like, oh, my internet's just gone a bit buggy or whatever, all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Immediately infuriates me.
Mm-hmm,
but back then it was like, I don't know, there was a certain like magic to it. It was like suspense.
Yeah, that's true. The anticipation would build. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas now, if something was buffering at the wrong time, you'd be like, I might as well just kill myself. This sucks. This is the worst. But yeah, yeah. Look, we should probably get off this topic.
This is going to be the loosest intro to the podcast ever. After,
what were we talking about before?
I don't know.
Oh, we talk about a hotel. I went to a hotel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Emma got me 2 nights in a hotel for Father's Day. Basically, the first Mother's Day after Coco was born, I sent Emma to a hotel. And every Mother's Day since, she's been like, am I going to the hotel? And every Mother's Day, I've been like, nope. Not really. But she sent me... So I went away on Friday, I guess. And I stayed in a hotel. This is in Greenwich. I went and stayed in the hotel for the night. It was in Greenwich because the next night Emma joined me and we went to see Lily Allen at the O2.
Oh, fun. Was it good?
So yeah, it was good. It was good. It'll come up later.
Okay.
So Emma stayed with me one night there and I had one night to myself, but I was away from the family from like, you know, midday on Friday until early afternoon on Sunday. So I had a really good rest. But when she did this, I was kind of like, you know what? I want to give her a little break too. And there's a hotel in Richmond that we often send each other to. Like, it's got a spa, it's got a pool, it's got hot tubs outside. It's really nice. So I was like, I'm going to get her a night there as well. And, you know, she's been applying for jobs lately. She's now accepted one. But, you know, she's been applying for jobs lately. She'd been like waiting to get notes back on the second draft of her book. Like, she's just been doing a lot. So I was like, I'll send her there. So she was there last night in a hotel. So we've actually both had 2 nights away in the last week. And again, it will come up later, but I recommend it.
What, just taking time away from everything?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll save it for later. But,
okay,
you know.
Sure.
Look, we've got a load of shit to get
we
through
have a lot
today.
Of shit so, to get through.
So shall we do it? Like, so our idea was like, there are a bunch of big moves. There are a bunch of big players. And it does feel like all of them are getting quoted insane prices. Like at the moment, it just seems like everyone's like 100 mil. 130 mil, like whatever, like just any old number that comes into their head. And so we thought we'd go through some of them and say who is worth a big fee and who is not. So we're going to rip through these. Okay, so let's start with the biggest fee of all that we've heard this summer.
We could start with the one that's been confirmed today. Depends what you want to.
Is that Anderson?
Yeah.
Okay, because there have been a few that have been confirmed today. Like that's the thing, right? You've got like Tottenham.
Oh, paying, yeah, that one. We didn't
have
that one.
Tottenham paying over 80 mil. For two separate midfielders. Yeah. Okay, so we start at Elliot Anderson. Okay, so Elliot Anderson is going to be about 116 mil without add-ons, rising to about 130, it seems. He is 23. He's at the World Cup right now. He had a very good season last year, but a season that was a notable step up from the previous season in the Premier League. He's going to Man City. Interesting question about what they do with that midfield. Like, is the intention that he plays with Rodri? Is the intention that he plays with someone else? Because he's not a six, Anderson. Like, you don't... He can... For Forest, he can collect the ball from the keeper or from the back line and then run your possession game. But for City, I don't know. I do think he is more of an eight. Like, you want him to be able to get forward with his passing. You also don't want him kind of staying still because he's pretty mobile and physical.
He is decent defensively, though, so I think like six is...
He's decent, but like I think he needs to learn the pressing game, definitely, if he's going to play eight. But go on. Where are your feelings with Anderson?
No, I still see him as a six. I see this. The only reason that I can see them spending this amount of money on a player like Anderson at Anderson's age is that he will be the long-term successor to whatever the Rodri role becomes in this new iteration of City post-Pep.
Okay.
Maybe they'd end up kind of completely reinventing that midfield, but I feel like it'll make sense to dovetail with Rodri. I think he's a very, very multifaceted player and you can see elements of eight and elements of six in him, but I do think that as he ages, he can age into a six as much as he can age into an eight. I think his defensive attributes are good. I think if City are going to be as good as they have been, or if City aren't going to drop off a cliff, I think they're going to have a couple of wobbly years while they transition. But the infrastructure and the kind of club notoriety that they've built in the Pep era will, you know, keep them up at the right end of the top teams. So I think you can get away without being like an absolutely outstanding elite defensive midfielder as a six there because you just have less to do.
But my issue with him as a six is not really to do with his defense. Like,
it's that you're not getting enough going forward. Or you're missing out on the top end of his forward output?
It's more just that it's not, I don't think it's particularly what he's good at. Like, I think that he needs to have freedom to move around. And I think his passing is good at linking the midfield to the attack. To me, the role of the six is collect the ball from the back line, relieve pressure, set the tempo of the game. Like, I don't actually think that is who he has been. Like, Wharton to me is much more of a six than Anderson is. Rodri is a six. Like, there aren't that many like real sixes in the Premier League now. So it may just be that they end up with a kind of twin eight system or something. But I look at Anderson at the moment and I think, yeah, well, if Anderson plays alongside Rodri, it seems a bit weird to be like, but then later on he'll be the Rodri replacement, because you're like, but he's going to develop as somebody partnering with a Rodri rather than as a Rodri, right?
Yeah, like, I think it's interesting if they dovetail him as like he's Rodri's successor or he's Rodri's partner. I think that is, once they define that, will probably, you know, give more clarity on what the plan actually is for him. Because I think you're right, if they pair him with Rodri, then you can't expect him to be Rodri once Rodri leaves. Whereas if you play him under Rodri and let him build into the role as he, you know, go ages towards like peak years, then that makes more sense for Rodri's departure for him to then take over that mantle. Difficulty there is you've paid 120 million quid for a guy who you're not planning to start, which is a lot of money. So
he's definitely going to start.
So he's definitely going to start. So if he's going to start, then do you drop Rodri? Or this is the thing. It's like, it depends on Rodri's fitness as well. But it feels like everybody fit, everybody available for selection, Rodri and Anderson will operate in a midfield together in some formation, which again isn't in my idea. If their idea is for him to long-term replace Rodri, not necessarily ideal way to start him adapting to life at City.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know what Maresca is going to do with these guys. But on the point of Anderson's quality, I guess, I think he's great. I think he's really good. He had decent ball-winning numbers last season. I think a lot of the stuff are like, he won possession the most times. They're talking about like recoveries and things.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's bullshit stat. And also, he played more minutes than all the other people.
Well, I think
positions.
If you do it per 90, you know, it's like, yeah, his I think recovery's still a thing. You know, it shows mobility in midfield in that he can get
I
to.
I agree, but there are also teams that like want their midfielder to do that, and other teams that want their forward to do that. There are also teams that have more possession and therefore have fewer opportunities. You know, when they're like, he had more recoveries last season than Rice and Rodri, I'm like, well, yeah, of course he did.
Because he played for
Nottingham Forest.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? But I agree that there's some like savvy there. I think that there's some defensive output. And I think defensively, he will end up being really good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you see at the World Cup, there are times in the press where he goes and they just play around him. Like, he gets caught under the ball, right? So the ball goes past him and then he's ahead of play and he's got to, like, turn around and run back. Like, there's a bit of that. Passing, I think he's excellent. He's not a superstar passer like Rodri yet, but he is a very, very good passer, you know? Like,
yeah.
Rodri is special, and Anderson is a really reliable progressive passer. One thing I would like him to add to his game as well is his ability to carry. So what's interesting about the Rice Anderson combo at the World Cup is if space opens up in front of Rice carries into it, and he'll pass as well, but Rice wants to carry.
Mm-hmm.
When space opens up in front of Anderson, he still looks for a pass.
He passes through it, yeah,
and that's because he's good at passing. But I do think that in order to get more out of him, he probably does need to recognize that, like, there are moments where he can carry, even if it's not his game, that he can carry till someone commits and then play the pass. Like, there's a little bit of that that he might need to work on. But he's basically the ideal age. Like, he's young enough that you can get 8 good years out of him.
Yeah. And he's still not fully formed.
Yeah, he can develop. He's old enough, of course, that you can drop him right into the team now and have no serious concerns about it. Wages probably won't be insane. I mean, obviously they will, I guess, if you pay 130 mil, but wages relatively will not be insane. They probably won't be as insane as like Julian Alvarez. Homegrown. Like, I think there's a lot of, like, he's got good size. Like, he's not super tall, but he's burly. He's very
broad.
Yeah, I kind of think it's a great move. I really like it.
Yeah.
I mean, what else they do with the midfield is the question, but there are rumours they want Buadi as well, but then they'd loan him back for this season. And I was like, if you could do that, I mean, obviously then you are choosing that. You are saying Anderson's going to be the six, but Anderson Buadi could be your midfield for like the best part of a decade. That is that's pretty good stuff, I think.
I mean, on at the minute, it is good.
You're more on the fence than me, I can tell.
I think Elliot Anderson is a fantastic player. I think I put him in as my like player to watch for in the World Cup. I think before England turned up with some horrific performances in the group stages, I thought he was going to be one of England's low-key most important players. I think he had a great season, and he's at a great age, and there's loads of stuff about him that is really, really top tier and potentially elite as he hits his peak years. The fee is big, and it feels like a season or two early for me. And I guess you have to buy the player when the player becomes available. So there is always risk in the transfer market. And it feels like City have taken a bit of a risk here because they're betting on the player that they're confident he'll become versus waiting another season. The thing is, he's had basically one good Premier League season. Like one genuinely good Premier League season.
That is undeniable.
And people question, he's now gone for more money than Bellingham. He's gone for more money than Declan Rice. People question Declan Rice fee when that happened. Declan Rice had 17,000 minutes at West Ham in the Premier League. Elliot Anderson has like 7,000 minutes at Forest in the Premier League. Like, for me, it just feels a little bit early for a price this big. I would like another season in the same quality as he put in last season. That is difficult, though, because you then get into the territory where you come up against greater competition, or you could sit, like, rest on your laurels too long, and all of a sudden the player's gone to Madrid, or he's gone somewhere that you could have had him last season and paid a bit of a premium for him, but you got him and you locked him down for 10 years and he was one of the first names in your team sheet for a decade. You missed that opportunity because he didn't go early enough. That's the double-edged sword. I just think when we're talking about the most expensive English player of all time, I think that is pretty punchy for Elliot Anderson at 23 with one very good season coming out of Nottingham Forest. I do think it's punchy. That's and obviously, fair. You know, with inflation and the market kind of is generally growing quite a substantial rate year on year. These like the whole reason we're doing this segment is because the fees that are just casually being bandied about are like over 100 mil, just as casual, bidding starts at 100 mil. Crazy stuff. Whereas before, even 3-4 seasons ago, that price level was kind of basically reserved for the truly top players coming in or at peak age. For me, I think it's a really good signing. I think he'll be good. And I think most clubs in the world would love to have him. My only concern is that if we're talking about price and value, I think the price is higher than its current value. And that therein lies the risk. There's about 25% of an overpayment, 20% maybe of an overpayment of where he actually is based on his age and what he's done and what he's proven he can do. Because like, remember Adam Wharton had a fantastic season and everybody was like, oh, he could go for big money. And then he kind of came back down to earth. And
but he was like 20.
I know, but like nothing ever kind of materialized from that. Everybody... He lost his flavour of the month or flavour of the season.
I think we still think Anderson's good. And if someone paid like 80 mil for Anderson this window, I wouldn't have a problem with that.
You mean Wharton?
Yeah, for Wharton. Sorry.
Yeah. I know,
I'd be okay with that.
But what I'm saying is that what I would want would be the same treatment as Wharton got, in that maybe just take a step back and then we'll see in another season if he's with a bigger sample size.
But equally... I do get the sample size thing. But then on the other hand, you look at it and you're like, well, maybe he has a later peak. And if you had the opportunity to buy Rice right now at 23, would you do it? I'm like, yeah, you would. Everybody in the world would do it. It's just...
Yeah, but hindsight's never wrong. You know, this is... Sure. What I'm saying is...
Sure, but Anderson had a very good season last year in the best league in the world.
Yeah.
Despite playing for a shitty side. I agree. It would be nice to have another season of top output. I definitely agree. However, and in a sense, whenever we're at 100 mil... There's just the part of me that thinks 100 mil should be reserved for megastars.
Yeah.
However, homegrown player, 23 years old, proven in the Premier League, in a position of need for Man City. I think if it's an overpay, it's a small one. You know, I think it's an over. I think that I'm actually fine with this price.
Yeah, it's a risk I would take, but it is still a risk nonetheless.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but a big transfer is always a risk. But I'm completely fine with this one. Which cannot be said of some others. So should we go to Julian Alvarez next? Who here the asking price seems to be, well, I don't know, is it 150 mil? Because Real Madrid apparently bid 150 mil, got turned down. Yeah. Barcelona bid, what, 130, got turned down. I think there's the thought that PSG could be interested, that Arsenal are interested. He is a very good player. This is crazy to me.
Unbelievable.
Like, Julian Alvarez is... The thing is, he's about as proven as it gets, right? In the... There's pretty much no weakness in his game. Like, he's a good dribbler. He's creative. He scores goals. He works incredibly hard. Like, he's an okay age. He's not... It's not ideal, but it's fine. He's played really well in two top leagues and at the international level. He can play out wide. He can play behind a striker. He could play as the central striker. Like... He does a load of things. All that said, is he a superstar in any one of those things? Like to me, the argument that Alvarez is amazing is kind of based on the fact that he can play all those positions really, really well. But fundamentally,
like a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, but fundamentally, he's going to play for your team somewhere.
Yeah,
right. He's going to. So, is he worth 150 mil as a centre forward? I don't know. Maybe this isn't fair. Maybe you do say, well, okay, he'll get some left wing minutes, he'll get some striker minutes, he'll get some second striker minutes, and that'll make him worth it. But I just look at it and I'm like, Julian Alvarez should go for 80 to 100, in my opinion. Like, if he went for...
Oh, so you're going like over 30% overpayment, this is?
Yeah, for sure. I was like, if Julian Alvarez went for 80, I would be like... That's a really good... That's a totally fine price. If he went for 100, I'd be like, pushing it. Anything over that, I start to think, you're not an elite centre forward, though. You're not an elite centre forward. You're a really great attacker. You are really great. But for that money, you're like, I want one of the best goal scorers in the world. And maybe he can be that, because we haven't actually seen him. That's the other thing. We haven't seen him just play like as a centre forward in a team that is trying to get him chances, right? And he certainly got more shots when he was at City than he does at Atleti. But to me, it's like there's this bundle of skills that we can use in lots of ways. Like, it's kind of like the better version of Morgan Rogers, where you're like, is Morgan Rogers a left winger or a second striker or a striker? Like, don't really know. But he's got a bunch of talents that we think we can use in loads of different ways. Alvarez is a better version of that. But I still look at him and think, score more goals or assist more goals, like,
yeah,
in order to be worth the one of the biggest fees in the history of football.
I don't think you can go out and spend 150 million quid on a player and then that player not have like a set position that you build the team around. I think that fee is a superstar money where you basically like build a franchise around them. I don't think you buy a player for that amount of money and you're like, oh yeah, you'll play centre forward, then we'll move you to left and we'll move you about. I think you play them where they want to play, basically, or where you think they're best. I don't like Swiss Army knife players, versatile players.
What about Bellingham? Like, that doesn't apply to Bellingham.
What do you mean?
Well, Bellingham didn't have like a set position and it was like he's going to play here. Part of Bellingham's value is that Bellingham for Real Madrid he could play as an 8, a 10 or a striker.
It was more like a second striker, but I think...
No, he played as a real striker for a minute.
I think central midfield is slightly different when you're playing as an 8 to 10. I don't think, like, I think left wing to centre forward is a bigger jump than 8 to 10. I think those all fall within the remit of central midfield. Bellingham is like an attacking minded central midfielder that ended up kind of second striker in his first season.
I don't know. I think that's a bit of a stretch, but sure.
I just don't see spending £150 million on a forward and saying, oh, he's going to be like a Swiss Army knife that we're just going to plug in where he's needed. I think you build a team around a player of this. If you're going to go for 150 million quid, you build a team around this player. And my issue with Julian Alvarez going for such a ridiculous fee is that he's then brought into the realms of Haaland and Mbappe's and Kane's, like literally the best players in the world right now.
Yeah.
And for him to merit a fee as big as that, he needs something, even just at least one metric, to be in like an astronomical stratospheric level of output that these players, Haaland, Mbappe, Kane, have. And Julian Alvarez just doesn't have that. He doesn't have that one or two just unbelievable astronomical levels of output in one or two metrics. If you look at him last season, he was a 0.3 not expected goals per 90, and he's never been above 0.45. If you look at Mbappe, 0.66, Haaland, 0.78, Kane, 0.8, non-penalty expected goals per 90 all of last season. He is just a stretch back off the truly, truly top level elite forwards, but the price that this is being quoted for and the prices that are being knocked back are the prices that you would expect to go for a player of the quality of Haaland, of Mbappe, of Kane. Well, I suppose Kane at an appropriate age. And he's just not that player. He just doesn't have that ridiculously astronomical stratospheric level of output in some form of his game that could justify a fee of this big. I would say like 110 would be my upper limit for him. I think it's still a bit of an overpayment, but he is a proven goal scorer. He's a like you say, there's no real weakness in his game. He is a very, very good top level attacking player that's versatile, can score, can assist, has done so regularly across his entire career. He is a pretty sure bet of a good output for a forward. He is just not worth £150 million worth of output.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. I love the player. And if a team bought him, I wouldn't say, wow, you've wasted your money. Like, for Barcelona in particular, getting the value of multiple positions from him would be more worth it than, say, Real Madrid. That doesn't really make sense to me. Obviously, they're like, he can play up front, but he can't play on the right. They still don't solve their issues on the left. And, like, I don't know what their plan was there. Like, if Real Madrid were going to spend a fortune on someone, an elite right winger would be the way to go, I guess. But, or something. Or a proper centre forward, so long as they sell one of their other superstars. You know, for Arsenal, you're like, how much does he give you over, like, Havertz? Does he give you 150 mils worth of value over Havertz? No, I don't think so.
And he'll actually significantly hurt your movement in the transfer windows for the next few years because of it.
Sure.
I think it makes it more difficult than he causes more problems than he solves.
Yeah, so he's like one of my favourite players around. You know, I think he's a fantastic player. This is crazy money. Okay, next up, we've got Saeed Elmala. Saeed Elmala, Brentford supposedly agreed a fee of 50 mil for him earlier in the window. He decided not to go. Now Liverpool are apparently in for him. He is 19 years old. He's a big guy, actually. He's a deceptively large guy. He is a great dribbler and ball carrier. He gets tons of shots, tons of XG from wide areas. Like, there's a lot to like in his game. I don't know if I like him for Liverpool. I talked about that on the transfer flow earlier today. I don't know if I like him for Liverpool, but 50 million euros for him, for a guy who played for a crappy Köln team last season and got, you know, nearly 20 goal involvements in the league. And by the way, that's obviously a big deal as well when you play fewer games. When you play a 34-game season, you know, the idea of
21 goal involvements in the Premier League.
Yeah, exactly. And he, as a teenager,
19, in his first season
in the Bundesliga.
So, also from under 2,000 minutes as well. Like, he didn't.
He's sick. I think he's sick. I think he's really, really good. If you want a goal scoring wide player, he's great. If you play more of a narrow setup, like, for instance, if you are Brentford and you think, oh, maybe we can play him in a front three, we could play him in a front two, like, we could just play him in loads of situations where his job is like run fast, carry ball, get shot, like, he would be great. I think 50 million euros is a really good price for him. I would do that in a heartbeat if he fitted the needs of my team.
Yeah, I think there's loads to love about his season. This is the thing, again, it cuts both ways. He is young, he is unproven, he has 2,000 minutes, under 2,000 minutes in a European top five league. But in those 2,000 minutes that he played, he was getting like 3.5 shots per 90. Only 5 players had more shots per 90, and 3 of them were Bayern players. This is a 19-year-old kid playing for a Köln team who finished 14th in the Bundesliga last year.
And you've seen him run past Bayern players. You know, you think about that insane solo goal he scored against Bayern, you look at that and you're like, well, if he could just breeze past Bayern players, you know, if he's strong enough and fast enough to do that, he is going, physically, he's clearly at Premier League level, I think.
He
is definitely fast enough.
He's over 6 foot, like, that helps as well.
Yeah, exactly. So you look at all that thing and I think, I don't have concerns about whether he can make the physical transfer, you know, whether it's in the first season or not, I don't know, but he will do it. And I think he will get shots. He just gets so many shots that he could lose a shot a game and still be a really good shot getting wide player.
And, like, even last season, only Elise managed more dribbles ending in shots than him per game. And when you have players, you get lots of shots. I think sometimes it can be a bit stat paddy if the shots are taking a really bad shot. But his XG per shot is 0.15 across that season, which is quite a bit higher than the average.
Really good.
So for a player taking that volume of shots across the season with that high quality is a really, really good sign, especially because he's 19. He's able to dribble, he's able to make shots for himself. The shots he's taking are frequent and of high quality. There's so much to love about this young player in literally 2,000 minutes in a European top five league. Obviously, that comes with risk because 50 million euros is still 50 million euros for a 19-year-old who has played under 2,000 minutes. But from what you see, on-ball ability, shot-getting ability, shot-quality ability, his general just goal involvement output last season as a 19-year-old in the Bundesliga, fantastic. And his physicality and speed, you know, this is a roll of the dice that I'm very, very willing to take at that price.
Agreed. Agreed. He seems great. And yeah, like I say, I don't love him for Liverpool, but if Brentford had got this done, I'd have said that is an amazing signing for Brentford. And to be clear, that's not to say, oh, he can't play at a higher level. He can. I just think he's the wrong fit for Liverpool. Like if, God, I don't even know who the right team would be for him, but there are higher level teams than Brentford who could really use a Saeed Almala. Okay, moving on to Morgan Rogers. Morgan Rogers, what was it last season? 14 goal involvements, I think, in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Played a lot of minutes, but now, yeah, 120 mil, apparently. Like, we were hearing kind of 70, 80, and I thought, well, I wouldn't pay that, but that's quite reasonable.
In the market, I think it's fine.
I know, but whenever you think that, you know, and it's Aston Villa selling, you know that they're going to ask way more. Like, Aston Villa are always going to demand a significant overpay. And I just don't get the Morgan Rogers thing. I mean, there are loads of people I know who really love him. Whether they want him for Arsenal or not, they love him. I don't get it. Like, he does lots of things that are fun. So he'll receive the ball, turn, and drive into space. That's great. I don't think that that's a problem for Arsenal. Arsenal have guys who can do that. The problem is that they're often not carrying into space. Like, Saka can carry into space. Madueke can carry into space. Ødegaard can do it. You don't have to be fast to do it. You honestly don't. Like, you need to be able to turn. Miles Lewis-Skelly's not fast. He can do it. Like, there are Calafiori can certainly do it. Like, there are loads of guys who can do this. Now, being able to receive on the turn and get away from somebody, that is important. At the same time, that is what Eberechieza was meant to be able to do. Like, that is what a young Eze certainly did. We're talking about Arsenal here. But I guess the question is, you know, like, who's going to pay this money? I just think Morgan Rogers is a talented player who is not 21.
Yeah, he's turning 24.
He's turning 24. So he is in his peak years. And he still looks like a work in progress to me. And he takes shots, but he doesn't actually get that many shots. And he doesn't do any creative passing pretty much at all.
Mm.
And he doesn't dribble. He carries. When there's space, he can carry. But he doesn't beat his man, really. So I just look at that and I'm like, well, I don't get this. Like, if United hadn't done Cunha, then Rodgers might have made sense to them because he does a lot of the Cunha stuff. And obviously he's younger. But this one is baffling to me. Like, again, the issue with Rodgers is if Rodgers plays left wing for an elite team, does he improve their left wing? Like, does Rodgers improve Arsenal's left wing? I mean, I'm sure loads of people are like, yeah, of course. I don't think he does. Like, is there a position that Morgan Rodgers just improves for Arsenal? Like, flat out improves? No. He's worse than Arsenal's 10. He's not a left winger. I can't make head or tail of it. It doesn't make sense to me.
He's not better than Martinelli or Trossard left wing. He's not better than Odegaard as a 10, and he's not better than Saka right wing.
No, and he's not a striker, or at least not currently.
Yeah.
Like, he is a guy who I think is really well suited to playing kind of an attacking midfield winger hybrid role for a team that is not elite.
Yeah, I think Phil is like actually quite a good level for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think he will be able to go higher, but right now, I think the best parts of his game, like, you saw him for England, like, coming on for England in, I think, against Ghana, maybe the Panama game, but certainly against Ghana. And I was like, what is Morgan Rogers going to do here? Like, except for have a shot from distance, what is Morgan Rogers going to do? Like, Morgan Rogers cannot pick a pocket. Like,
no,
he cannot, like, he doesn't actually, like, have great defensive instincts, I think. He does a bit of defending. Like, it's not like he doesn't. And what I don't think he can do either is just, like, thread a ball through into the tiniest bit of space. Like, he doesn't.
No, he's like a runner really, more in the play. That's not his game.
Yeah, so I'm like, he's like a second striker. He's like a more mobile. He's like a Dele Alli, who's less of a presence in the box, but more of a carrier. I like him. I just, that price, again, is a price for one of the best attackers in the world. 14 goal involvements in a full Premier League season is not one of the best attackers in the world. Like, that's fewer goal involvements than Gyökeres got.
And like, he's got 38 goal involvements across two seasons. Again, like, nothing special.
It's pretty good.
We're not saying he's not a good player. I'm saying he's not a £120 million player. Certainly not at his age. Like, 38 Premier League goal involvements in 2.5 seasons by 24.
Yeah. In 2.5 seasons, like, that half is also a bit of a knock.
Good, but not outstanding. Like, if we were talking about 38 Premier League goal involvements across two seasons at 21, very interesting. But at 24 across 2.5 seasons, good but not great. And good but not great is not worth £120 million.
I'm never in favor of paying a fortune for these like 23, 24 year olds who are promising.
Yeah.
At 23, 24, it's like you should be a proven contributor.
It's like the Jesse Lingard fallacy where he's like literally 29 and everybody's acting like he's 21. The Wilfred Zaha, you know, next season's going to be his breakout season. It's like, mate, he's 26 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
Like he's broken out. This is the player. Yeah, I think Morgan Rodgers has tipped into the wrong side of young in that we're seeing basically, at least we're close to what the finished top end article is for him. And while it is a good player, it's not a league leading player. And you need to be a league leading player for a price that Villa are expecting.
People with like Madueke are just like, write him off. Like he's no good. He's not good enough to play for a top team. And he is, what, 3 months older than Rodgers? And with Rodgers, it's like, he can learn. He can learn. He can be like, Rodgers is just not a 10. He's just not a 10 at all. He doesn't do anything that I want a 10 to do. I want a 10 to demand the ball in attacking positions. The 10 to be like, give me the fucking ball. I will be the one to make stuff happen. Berghieza doesn't even do that enough for me. Like, he will just drift out of a game. Rodgers is exactly the same. And yeah, on the wing, is Rodgers... Rodgers has like great athleticism in that he is fairly fast and he's strong and he can run all day. But he is not super fast. Like, most fullbacks in the Premier League, I think, can keep up with Rodgers.
Yeah.
And he's not an amazing dribbler. I'm just like, what's the point of you? Well, again, it's kind of, we think that you can contribute to the team in multiple ways. Okay, I get that, but Arsenal are not a team, a work in progress. Arsenal are a team who basically need to just add an elite left winger. Arsenal just need to add an elite left winger. So
yeah,
they
Arsenal,
don't need
Arsenal
just
go- aren't trying to money ball it.
Oh, he's going to cover so many positions for us. What the fuck are you talking about? You're in like year six of the project.
Won the fucking league.
Exactly. You're just like, no, you should just get a left winger who's like, what do I do? You know, all the stuff that you expect left wingers to do.
That at a really good level.
I do that at an elite level. Yeah. That's my game.
Yeah.
So on that note, should we move on to Bradley Barcola?
Ooh, yes.
Bradley Barcola, kind of same ballpark. 120 mil is what they're talking about now. I mean, that is kind of just like a guess. We have no idea, but we've never really seen PSG sell a player that they wanted to keep who was also at this age, you know, 23. Bradley Barcola, okay, there are question marks here. He has been playing for a super team, and so his numbers are hilarious. He has had some sub minutes, which also contributes. He has not played, you know, like every minute in Ligue 1 because PSG don't do that with any of their players. He, at the same time, would struggle to do more with the minutes that he's played. Like, he has been phenomenal. He's an amazing impact sub. He's got unbelievably explosive pace. I think his pace rivals Mbappe's. Like, because he's also got those really long legs that Mbappe has, you know, those deceptively long legs.
Yeah.
He's got great acceleration. According to the numbers, he creates at a very high level. I don't really think that's true because he plays for PSG. He dribbles at a pretty good level. Like his raw dribble numbers aren't that high, but the effectiveness of his dribbles is very good. He basically does a bit of everything. He gets tons of shots. Tons and tons of shots. And he is, you know, just about pre-peak, just coming into his peak. I think he is an exceptionally good attacking prospect. I think he's already a very good attacker. If he were to become one of the best attackers in the world, that seems plausible to me. I don't know if he will do that, but I think if you were to sign him for 120 mil, I think that you'd get a minimum sub-elite attacker for the majority of their career, and possibly you would get one of the best attackers in the world, maybe.
Yeah, I think he's a fantastic player, and we've just come off the back of talking about Morgan Rodgers, who's operating in similar positions, being quoted for similar prices, and for me, this is just night and day's harsh, but I think there's so much to love about Barcola, and maybe it's just because he's a really exciting player, but what he did last season was fantastic. He's looked great in the World Cup. He's got the pace. He's got decent size. He's great on the ball. He gets through the shots. I think there's so much to his game that is already knocking on the elite level floor. I guess like he's knocking on the door of the elite level. He's right there. And we're about to enter what are his true peak years, I think. Is this an overpay? If it goes for £120 million, potentially. Again, these are all
By a little bit.
A little bit. A little bit. But the gamble, I think, is worth it in this instance because Barkley seems like a player whose peak years could be really unbelievable. And there's so many ways in which he can significantly move a needle in a team, in a match, in a squad. And I think those moments or players with that level of that explosiveness, that ability to create something from nothing through getting shots off dribbles, everything that Barkley does is exactly what you want from a really dynamic left winger, and you would get all of his peak years. I think you take the risk, and like you say, worst case scenario, you probably pay 120 mil for a player you should have paid 80 mil for, and he turns out to be a very good left winger, not one of the world's best left wingers. That's probably the worst case scenario for Barkley at 120, and he's so young that even if it doesn't work out, you can shift him off in 3 seasons when he's 26 for probably a decent fee as well, because he's not going to, the level he's operating at now at 23, he's not going to drop off a cliff. Like we can see what the player will become or could become, and he's much closer to it than a player who's 19. There isn't as much risk here, but I do think it's a slight overpayment. But I do think that of all the players out there on the market at the minute, or whether he's on the market or not is a question, but of all those players that we're talking about, he seems like one of the ones who could actually really have a truly special peak window. And I think 120 is a palatable overpayment for the chance. It's a bit of a gamble to get what could be like a truly special player when he's 25, 26.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, like the worst case scenario for him goes like he arrives in the Premier League and he can't get the same separation from Premier League defenders, and his dribble numbers drop to like, you know, 1.4 per 90, or like he keeps high dribble numbers, but he fails with a bunch of dribbles in order to get that, and he's not really creative. Like you end up with a guy who gets lots of shots, but is really an off-ball player and only occasionally does something with dribbling or creating. That would be the worst case scenario. That's still probably like a better version of Martinelli.
And also his pace and explosiveness is so even extreme. Even if the defenders are better and like his ball control ability isn't so outstanding that he can like weave his way through tons of defenders closing him down. In isolation in 1v1, defenders defending in space, his pace alone is enough for any defender in the league to struggle. And I think like when you have a player who's that explosive, even if his numbers go down, I think you can create scenarios to get him on the ball with a defender defending in isolation 1v1s. And that's when he can just use his raw physical abilities to blow past players. And I think like, yeah, okay, his numbers could drop, worst case scenario. But I think even if they do drop, his physical gifts are so substantial that he'll still have pretty good numbers.
I agree. I think that he's fantastic. And I think 120 is okay. Like it really is okay. Like if you get him for 100, you'd obviously be happier. But he's coming from one of the richest clubs in the world, and he's won 2 Champions Leagues with them. Like, I think that probably 120 is kind of what you'd expect, but he's great. Okay, Manzambi, Swiss midfielder, having a very good World Cup, heavily linked with Newcastle. Apparently, the price is around £42 million. A bit of a breakout season for him last year at Freiburg. He's 20. What do you think of this player? Like, I think he, like I say, he's had a really good World Cup. He's caught a lot of people's eyes playing as in quite an advanced role, like really playing kind of behind the striker. But what do you make of him overall?
Yeah, I mean, he had a pretty good season last season at Freiburg. 9 goal involvements from, again, like 2,000 minutes at centre mid. And again, this is a kid, he's 20 years old. This is his first true season. And I think coming into a central midfield role and certainly playing like the lion's share of the minutes in a squad is quite difficult for a young player because it is such an important and kind of like the heartbeat of a team. Only 3 Freiburg players played more league minutes than him, so I think it really shows that even though this is a breakout season, he kind of quickly established himself as a very integral and important member of the squad. You know, he gets a good amount of shots from like centre mid camera. He's getting over 2 shots per 90, third most in the squad last season. And again, this is a central midfielder. Granted, he has played a more advanced roles, but for I would consider him like an 8-10. So for over 2 shots per 90 as an 8-10, I think it's very tasty as a 20-year-old. Also, you know, he's good on the ball, most successful final third pass in the squad. And what's interesting about him, I think, is that while he has the most successful final third passes in the squad, he was only 8th for chances created per 90. But he does lead the team in open play expected assists per 90. So for me, what that says is that he's on the ball a good amount and the creation quality is there because he is a team leader in expected assists per 90 from open play. But it's just not the volume of creation there. So when he creates big chances. But the volume is what he's lacking there. The volume of chances created is what he needs to add. And he's 20 years old. And I think, in my opinion, it's easier to add volume to a naturally creative player than it is to add creativity or creative quality to just a big volume passer. So in these kind of central midfield attacking advanced roles, him on the ball, I think he is a really decent to good creative player that has the potential to really kind of develop it as he ages. I think there are some, you know, promising underlying numbers so early in his career. My issue with the overall transfer is because the destination is seemingly Newcastle. That's the biggest link, right?
Yes.
That's my concern because this guy had a very, very good season in Freiburg at 20 years old. He played a lot of minutes for the squad. He showed good elements of creative ability, on-ball creative ability from central positions. He got a good amount of shots per 90 from central midfield positions. He's 20 years old with, you know, 2,500 minutes in the Bundesliga. And I feel like if he goes to Newcastle for 42 million quid, people will say this is a Sandro Tonali replacement. And that is my concern.
Mm.
Because Sandro Tonali's just gone for huge money and is a hugely established and a good player, good Premier League proven player. If they he's a good Premier League player. Were bringing in Manzambi as a successor in a squad where he can be bedded in slowly over time, he can be exposed to the Premier League at an appropriate level and controlled, and his exposure to being dropped in central midfield is, we're going to do this in stages. Here's a player you can learn off that's actually going to be our main central midfielder. But eventually, we think you're going to become, at 22, what this guy is now. I think that's fine. That potentially works well. If the idea is to bring this guy in and be like, here's a Sandro Tonali-shaped hole that you're just going to fill from day one, I have huge concerns because he is really unproven and he's really young. And it's one thing doing it in the Bundesliga. It is a whole different kettle of fish doing it in the midfield of a Premier League team with the aspirations of Newcastle.
Yeah, I think it's just a great move, man. I just love it. Yeah, I think it's great. I think he's again a big guy and he is super mobile and he's got a bit more final third influence, which is something this Newcastle team are crying out for. They're also crying out for the opportunity to get younger. I imagine they try not to sell Bruno Guimarães now that they've sold Tonali and Gordon for so much money, but I still think they should consider doing that because...
We're cashing in on Bruno G?
Yeah, because one way or another, he's going to decline. He's going to decline in the next couple of years.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. Newcastle can't get caught in this idea that being ambitious means never selling your good players. Like, there are so many of these upwardly mobile teams who get that idea. They're like, well, we can't sell that player because we're ambitious. Spurs did this with Romero last season. They're like, we can't sell him. Like that, we're ambitious, aren't we? We shouldn't be selling our good players. No, if there's a really good offer on the table, or if they're the wrong age, or if there are other concerns, like they get red cards all the time and injured, then selling somebody at the top end of the market is not the worst idea. Now, changing over the whole midfield in the summer obviously has big risks. It does. But a bunch of teams are actually changing over a lot this summer, both in squad and in manager.
Yeah.
I think if you can get like 60 mil for Bruno Guimarães, like, or 65 maybe from Arsenal, like, I'd be quite tempted to take it and just like, and really go out. Because I also think that midfielders, good midfielders, somebody as good as Bruno, like those are hard to find. But good midfielders are all over the place. And actually, Newcastle might be better overall if their first 11 is not as good, but their squad is better. You know, like how good you are as a team is not just a function of how good your first 11 is. It's also about how good your squad is, especially now. And so I think that if they were to say, so if like their first two midfielders were not as good as Tonali and Bruno G, but midfielders three and four were way better than their third and fourth midfielders.
Yeah, so you make it up in the aggregate, basically.
Then you're cooking, especially because they play such an energetic style. Like the idea that you're going to get, you know, your two first choice midfielders just playing every minute, I think is silly. I love Manzambi. I do think he's got that influence in the final third, which is great. But you get a load of normal midfield stuff out of him. He's really, really young. Really young.
Yeah. But that's my concern.
Yeah, but he looks good. And he certainly doesn't look overawed at the World Cup, playing a slightly different role to the one he plays at club level. And for that price...
The price is really good.
For one of the, you know, best-liked young midfielders around. Like, defensive numbers are excellent. Like, tons of recoveries, tons of clearances. Great in the air, which is excellent. Like, good in all his duels, basically. He does a load of pass progression. He does a load of passing into the final third. He dribbles quite a lot for a midfielder. You know, he's at nearly 1.5 dribbles a game. He gets tons of XG and XA for a midfielder. He's at like 0.4 per 90, which is really strong. He can carry a little bit. Like, he can take set pieces. He's got a great cross on him. Like, there's loads of stuff in there that you look at and you think, oh, I can totally see how this guy helps Newcastle. So I would do this, and then I don't think Tonali's that hard to replace. I think Tonali's eminently replaceable player. Like, he's just a run around a bit guy. Like, that's all he does. Like, he is a decent defensive player. He's an okay box crasher. He doesn't actually do it as much as the common perception is. He's obviously not a progressive passer in the slightest. Like, I don't know, getting that money for Tonali is so funny. Like, if I got offered that money for Tonali after the, you know, he's been good in the Premier League. He's been good in the Premier League. He also sat out a year for gambling.
He did, yeah.
And you overpaid for him in the first place. Paid like 70 million in the first place. And at the end of it, you're turning a big profit on him when he's 26. It's funny as fuck. Yeah. So I think Manzambi, great option. Okay, last one. Crescencio Somerville. I put this in because he has been linked to Manchester United. By all accounts, he's one of Man United's top winger targets this summer. Just got relegated with West Ham.
Mm.
He's at the World Cup as well. Oh, no, he's not. The Netherlands are out, but he was at the World Cup as well. I think the price, rumored price, is kind of 50 mil, which is, I mean, if relegated West Ham turn Matheus Fernandes and Crescencio Somerville into like £135 million, that'll be fucking hilarious. Like, that's out of this world.
Yeah, I mean, West Ham getting relegated should spark like a fire sale. And £50 million. So say this is a fire sale, right? You would knock 30% minimum off a player probably if they're going to try and move out of a team that's been relegated. So that would put this like adjusted fee at like 80 mil, which is insane. And I think 50 mil is too much. Like, I just don't really rate Crescencio Somerville as that good a player. He's turning 25, so he's about to be on the wrong side of 25. And he has 10 goals and 5 assists in nearly 5,000 Premier League minutes at 0.28 goal involvements per 90. Like, everybody's saying, oh, he was elite in the Championship, or he had this amazing season in the Championship where he had like 0.7 goal involvements per 90. Don't care. I don't care. Dan James was pretty good in the Championship, and he was awful at United and just bad in the Premier League generally. Like, the output drop-off that we've seen between that Somerville season in the Championship and everything else that we've seen from him in the Premier League is huge. Like, last season, he was at under 0.2 expected goals per 90, less than Suchek. 2 shots per 90, which isn't awful, but still not huge volume, and it was only half a shot on target. Less than 1 chance created per 90, 0.1 expected assists per 90 from open play. This is last season in the Premier League. Granted, this is a relegated season for West Ham, so that does, you know, the tide raises and drops all boats, so a shit West Ham team will definitely affect his individual numbers as well. But across, you know, over just under 5,000 Premier League minutes, good enough sample size for a 25-year-old to determine whether he's actually a good Premier League quality player. Nothing in his numbers jump out at me. Nothing says that this guy's actually a really good left winger. He's also not big. He's 5'8". I have concerns about his physicality against the ever-increasing size of defenders and physical nature of defenders in the Premier League. Yeah, like, I think at the age he's at and the amount of time he's actually played in the Premier League, there's nothing in his numbers or in his performances or in his physical attributes to tell me that he is worth pursuing. Like, regardless of fee, I just don't think he's worth signing. And I find it strange that United are like, this guy is our top target, and they're going to go for like 50 million quid bids for a player who got relegated from the league last season. Like, I just think it's bad business all round from the club, from the negotiation element, and I just think the player is a pretty average Premier League player. Not a needle mover for a Neuer Champions League team, at least for this season.
Yeah, I have nothing to add on that. I agree with all of that. Like, he's fine. If he were 22, 23, then I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah, maybe take a risk on him. Like when West Ham took a risk on him, I was fine with that. I thought that he merited that. The one thing you could say is he's been playing for a really crappy team.
Yeah,
and if he gets fed consistently in better areas, then who knows? Maybe he can do more. Usually players can do a bit more. He's just not... There are many better uses of £50 million.
Yeah, like, I agree.
That's more than Saeed Elmala would cost.
Yeah.
Just do that instead. Or Antonio Nusa or Christos Solis or any of the other left wingers who have been linked around for sub-50.
This is an interesting one. This is genuinely interesting.
Yeah, he's an unusual one. I'd be intrigued. Okay, right, that just about does us. Shall we go on to the burn book? All right, it's time to open up the burn book. Do you want to go first? Do you want to go second? Do you want to go in? Do you want to go out?
If you're ready to go, do you want to go first? Because I'm struggling to find my notes. Happy for you to choose in or out, though.
All right, so what I'm taking out of the burn book, nights away in a hotel.
Okay.
So obviously, I would say that like a lot of people, a lot of millennials, in the mid-2010s, we principally would go away and stay in Airbnb, right? Mm-hmm. And we would still stay in hotels on a holiday, but not that often. And now I think with Airbnb, it's become so expensive that actually it's kind of come back round and hotels are worth their value again. But I'm not talking about just going away to stay in a hotel on holiday. I'm talking about basically a staycation in a hotel in the city where you live. So Emma and I probably do this once a year each, maybe twice a year. Like we'll send each other away to a hotel nearby. Now, there's a hotel we like in Richmond, which has a swimming pool and spa and stuff. So that obviously has an added element, and it's right on the doorstep of Richmond Park, and it's also, you know, very near our house. So there's loads to recommend it. But being able to go somewhere else for the night, get a really good night's sleep, get room service, swim in the pool, it is such a head clearer. Like it really is. Yeah. So the hotel that I stayed at in Greenwich the other day, it was just like a regular hotel. You know, it was like
I love that these are both the same week.
Yeah, I know, right? There were a lot of tourists staying there, actually. I thought it would just be kind of business people. But, you know, it was like a completely standard hotel. Like it was just, you know, you get your room and it's a nice clean room with a nice shower and everything. But it's not like loads of amenities like, yeah, you know, swimming pool or any of that shit. Like that was a pretty straight ahead normal hotel. But there is something magical about walking into the hotel and seeing the bed and being like, this is my little house for the next 24 hours. And also, even if you air condition your house in the heat, it's never as cool as a room that is air conditioned 24/7 for the entire year.
You get them so low as well.
I walked in and I was like, this room has been 19 degrees.
Forever.
Forever since the hotel was built. And it was just magical. And even if Emma said, oh, tomorrow I'll get both kids up and you don't have to, you can lie in, you're never going to sleep as well as you would sleep in the hotel.
Oh,
it's just really great. And I think that sometimes, you know, if you want to give somebody you love a little treat, you can normally find hotel prices that are not insane, you know, like relatively last minute hotel prices that are not crazy, and just send somebody you love away. Or if you're feeling overloaded, you know, if you're feeling really tired, a bit burnt out, you need a little change of scenery, give yourself one, or if you can, two nights in a hotel. The second night is a huge, it's like a force multiplier. It's amazing. Give yourself a night or two in a hotel. And if you can find one that's got a pool, then all the better. You know, like that is as well, just like a massive upgrade. But I really do recommend it if you're feeling a bit burnt out. I promise it will help with it. And then get an early night. Because you, it doesn't matter how early you wake up the next day, but get an early night because you'll feel more refreshed. I think that the same 7 hours of sleep feel better if they start at 10. If they start at 10 and finish at 6, than if they start at midnight and finish at 8. Like that is my fervent belief. But I love it, and Emma and I do it occasionally. And honestly, when one of us sends the other, it is a magical experience. So I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I think there's something really special about walking in the hotel room and seeing like the king size made bed, and like the way that they make it, like the bed sheets are so taut.
Yeah,
and prison, it's just like
prison sheets.
Prison sheets. And you just know that, especially if it's like you've got nothing planned, for the next like 12 to 15 hours, I can just do literally whatever I care on yeah. whim. I can act on whim. I can get room service. I can go down to the pool. I have no other considerations to think about.
Yes.
Other than what I want to do at this very moment. And I think that's once you have kids as well, it's just a real rarity. Even if you get a lie-in at home, you're still awake when people wake up, you wake up as well. So you can stay in bed, but you're still awake. And yeah, your night's sleep is never as good as it is if you're just like, I am in this little, my own little ecosystem in this hotel now. I just can do what I want and there's nothing else to really consider.
Also, I was there on Friday night and there's a king size bed, and then at the end of the bed, there's the wall that separates it from the bathroom. And on the wall was a fucking massive TV. Mm-hmm. And ordinarily, I'm just kind of like, no one uses the TV in a hotel because it doesn't have any of the shit. So you just end up using your laptop if you want to watch something, right?
Yeah.
That has all your apps.
Or it has the apps and none of them work.
Yeah, it's like, well, you have to pay for access or you have to log in. I'm not doing that shit. But on this occasion, it was, you know, France, Norway was that evening on terrestrial television.
Yeah.
So I watched France, Norway on a fucking massive screen.
That was a good game as well.
It was great. I had a great time. So highly recommend it. And really, especially if you do have a tired spouse, if you've got kids or they've got a really busy job, it's actually better. And if they just, a lot of us as well, you know, we're in our mid-30s. It's not like you can't buy someone good presents, but generally speaking, if they want something, they buy it for themselves, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like an object. So it's nice to get people things like consumables or whatever that they wouldn't buy themselves. And a hotel is the best consumable there is, because if you can't give somebody a thing they want, they will definitely want time and relaxation.
Yeah.
They will always want those things. So give them those and they'll be happy. What are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm taking out of the burn book is experiencing new chapters with old friends.
Okay.
So we, earlier this week, so Sunday, so we're recording on what, Thursday? On Sunday, Monday, we had a few of my friends stay at the house. So it's a friend from Scotland who now lives in Hamburg with her husband, and they have a 6-month-old baby called Poppy. And they were going on holiday. So he, in Germany, I think you can choose when you take your paternity leave. So he's taken his paternity leave at 6 months. So they can go on this kind of extended summer trip where they're going to spend a month in Scotland. But basically, they drove down through Germany to the like northern Italy, Lake Garda, for a week holiday. Then he drove from Milan to our house in London while Alex and Poppy flew to Gatwick and then came to ours. And they stayed with us for a couple of nights. She went up to Scotland on the train and he drove up to Scotland. But they stayed with us Sunday, Monday night. And it was the first time that Poppy and Bonnie met. It's the first time I've seen her in probably a year, maybe. But one, it was just lovely to see them again. It was lovely to spend time with them. It was lovely to see our children interact and play together. And it was the first time I met Poppy as well. So that was lovely. But kind of halfway through the Sunday, it dawned on me that like we've been friends for 13 years or so. And we are now in a very, very different stage of our lives than we were when we met. And we are doing very, very different activities than we were doing when we met. Because like, you and I, we met about eight, 9 years ago. But
yeah,
nothing massive has changed in those times. Like we were kind of, like I would have been like late 20s. You would have been probably 29. I would have been 27 maybe when we met. Maybe a year younger. Like we were out the kind of back end of a lot of the shit you do in your early 20s. And as such, like our relationship hasn't changed a huge amount in 8 years. It's kind of been pretty stable. We've added a few kids. We've added a couple of wives. Nothing massively has changed in how we act in kind of what stage we are in life. We are in life. Whereas with Alex, like my first like memories of Alex and of our like activities were, you know, we would go, she played for the women's team and I played for the men's team. And there was like a group of probably 20 of us at that stage who were all 23, 24, 25. And what we do, we would go and play matches in the day, go to the clubhouse. And then we would literally just start on the booze. And then we would go out to this one nightclub that we'd always go to. And then every Sunday we would come back in the morning all hungover and get like a takeaway to the club and all just like lie in the back bar dying. And we would do that every week. And it was just like relentless levels of boozing. We have seen each other in some of the worst states. We have done just like the stupidest shit ever. as a collective, not just myself and Alex, like as a collective, all of like Clydesdale Hockey Club. And then like fast forward 12 years, we're sitting like apart from each other in my living room with our 2 6-month and 18-month old or 16-month old babies respectively, just like interacting. And it's really lovely that one, our friendships existed across multiple different iterations, because you lose people along the way. Yeah, like there's people that you go through and you're like, okay, I remember that guy from back in the day. Like we used to go out and get hammered all the time and he was a great time. But as we got older, we just grew apart. The list of close friends gets shorter and shorter as the older you get. So it's nice when the friends transition, like they cross over the bridges with you. And it was the first time I'd ever really thought about it, in that like all of our friends, or all of our close friends now, especially the ones that were there when I was like 23, they've seen two very different versions of my life and of their lives as well. And yeah, it's nice that we're still friends, but we're exploring kind of different stages of life. Very, very different. Like if we were 24 and when she first moved to Hamburg, she would have been like 26, 27 maybe. Me and a friend called Ewan, we would just go out and stay at hers, and we would just literally like, we would just go and just get smashed. And I literally went for a weekend and all I ate was currywurst for the entire weekend.
Sounds great.
And now it's very, very different because there's children involved and families, and like they don't really drink that much anymore, if at all. And like everything's kind of changed. Not necessarily in a better or worse way, just in a different way that is still also very, very good. So it's nice to experience kind of new chapters with friends that have kind of been with you for a long time and seen different versions of you. And it was something that I hadn't really put much thought into until I really saw, like, holy shit, like I know what we've been through together, and now we're sitting in like a pub in South London with our babies.
But it's weird that it doesn't feel crazy.
No.
You know, I think sometimes when you see friends who don't have kids, you know, so like when you have friends who aren't married and don't have kids, sometimes those friends will look at you and be like, wow, this is nuts. Like, I can't believe it. You know, like they watch you parent. But the other friends you have who have also gone through those stages, your relationship just evolves.
It just
moves kind of seamlessly into a new phase and you don't really think about it. But yeah, what will be weird, I think, is as our friends' kids get older, and we develop like actual relationships with them. You know, like one of my oldest friends, you know, we were at school together. He and his wife are moving to, you know, not quite our area, but pretty close. We'd always hoped they would, because they stayed in our house. They'd just come back from Canada. She's Canadian. Like they stayed in our house for like 2 months, our previous house, when we were in Paris on sabbatical. And so they loved our area, and we were always like, well, please come and live here. But we just assumed they were North London people forever. Now they're moving close to us. And I was like, oh, I'm actually going to see you all the time. It'll be great. And that idea is so exciting that I'll actually get to spend time with their kids. They've got two kids as well, and get to know them. And, you know, before long, their kids will be the age when I met Paul, which was in year 7. You know, we were in the same class at school. But
which is what, 11?
Yeah, but Coco's like 5-6 years away from that. It's absolutely insane. Yeah, it's a good one. Anyway, what I'm putting in the burn book really quick: people standing up who shouldn't stand up at gigs. So Emma and I went to see Lily Allen at the O2 the other day. We had seats. We had pretty good seats, but we had seats. And everybody in our section, like, they're mostly millennials, right? Because those are people who would pay attention to Lily Allen. And Lily Allen's new album, okay, it's recent, but it's literally about, like, you know, being married and getting a divorce, basically.
Yeah.
Like, it appeals to millennial and older people. There were two little girls in our section. And when I say little girls, I mean, they looked like 14 to me, which means they were probably 18. Like, they just looked like babies. And everybody was sitting down in our section. And then the music started and these two little girls just popped up instantly, and they started doing, honestly, the funniest like hot girl dance you've ever seen.
Like
they
TikTok started shit.
Oh my god, they were just literally like, I wish I could do it, but they were just kind of like it was
like choreographed stuff. Yeah,
it wasn't choreographed. It was like a pastiche of hot girl dancing, like they'd seen a hot girl in a film do it.
Sure.
And also, you know, like whenever, you know, if in the song it was like, and then I called you on the phone or something, they would like mime calling you. Like it was so ridiculous. It was like real white people shit. And there were a few objections to this. Like, firstly, it's not that danceable an album. Like, there's a dance influence in it, but most of the songs in it are sort of like groove away. So then everybody is just like grooving away, like sashaying away.
Yeah.
Like nobody's at, like you can't actually dance to it except for one song on the album. It's not that danceable, yeah, in my opinion.
And Lily Allen's quite like spoken as well.
Ish, yeah. But because these little girls stood up, everyone behind them had to stand up. And before long, the entire section was standing up. And then we all stood up for an hour. And I was just like, there's no need for this at all. If you wanted to stand up, why didn't you go in the standing section? Like, it's fucking ridiculous. So just like, I wasn't like that mad with these girls because they were like, when every now and then they take a break from their dancing to like hug each other. And they were obviously having a real experience, which I thought was very sweet. On the other hand, it was funny that the song they were like singing away to everything, dancing away like with every song. And then there are the couple of songs that are like almost too much, you know, that they were not singing and dancing to, even though they have the same kind of vibe as the rest of the album. But I was like, yeah, because these are about, you know, potentially like losing your sobriety and then maybe having your kids taken away because of that, you know. And I was like, these children just have no point of reference for any of this stuff. And you know, then there are bits in that song where they're singing, they're trying to sing along, and I was like, you just don't, the stakes of this song don't make sense to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're a child, which is like very,
you're
funny,
not old
to me.
Enough to buy a ticket for this song, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. But I wish they'd just fucking sat out. I wish they'd sat down. And I do think that as a section, we should have all turned around to them and said, we're all in our 30s. Some may be in their 40s. Sit the fuck down. There were also a couple of people further down who were like dancing the whole time and were also like jump up, start dancing people. But they were also like hugging each other and then filming themselves dancing the whole time. Like, it was so fucking weird. I was just like, why? Like, they're looking up at their phone, filming them as they like dance away to the music. And I was like, why are you here? Like, what are you? I don't understand why you're filming yourself. Like, that kind of shit always baffles me, to be honest. But anyway, if you want to stand,
go to the standing section.
Go to the standing section. The sitting section is for sitting. I'm 36. Fuck off. You know what? There were two people I respected. There was one woman on the other side of the aisle, and her section had ended up all standing up as well. Whereas on the other side of the arena, the sitting sections were still sitting down. And I was like, that's what I'm talking about. But this one woman, because she was on the aisle, she actually still had a view of the stage without having to stand up. Her friends had all stood up next to her, and she just stayed like resolutely sitting down for the entire show. And I was like, that's queen shit. And then behind me, there was a man who could not see if he sat down, but who still was like, I'm sitting down for the entire thing. And I really respected both of them. So so yeah, that's what I'm putting in the burn book. What are you putting in the burn book?
That is very, very strong. Very strong. Fully agree. What I'm putting in the burn book is having to change your barber.
Ooh, yeah, painful experience.
This is very, well, it's not happened yet, but the news was broken to me maybe yesterday. Or the day before. Yeah, I'm having to change my barber, Patrick. It's an ordeal. It's causing undue stress. So I get my hair cut at a place called Supply 91. The guy who cuts it is one of the owners called Maxwell. He's deciding to take a step back from cutting and focusing on like the business growth. Because the business has grown kind of crazily. When he sort of cut my hair a few years ago, they had one shop in Islington with like three chairs in it. Mm-hmm. They've now got like a bigger shop in Islington, one in Marylebone, one in Shoreditch, one in Regent Street, and then a residency at 180 Strand, Soho House. So like, they've done pretty well in the last 3 years. So he's like basically turning his focus to the business side of the company, but it's meant that he's no longer going to be cutting hair. So he sent me a text yesterday being like, just by the way, just let you know before like we announce it to the, like put it on the mailing list or whatever, I'm going to stop cutting hair.
But like, just like permanently?
I think at least at, because they've got plans to like bring out product lines. They're quite far down the line of that, and they're like, I assume they've got plans to like expand the business as well still, even through the four shops, or even past the four shops, because they've been in GQ's like list of top barber shops in London or top male grooming salons in London for like the last 5 years.
Sure.
Like, they've done really well. So I think it's at a point where he feels his time, like he's the foundations have been set enough that he can step away and focus on the business side of it, at least for now. And it'd be more beneficial to the company than when it was like they had three people working for them. So that puts me in the scenario now where he's going to recommend a barber to me. But even with that, and I do trust his judgment, but even with that, it's like, it's somebody new. I don't know this person. Who's this fucking rando cut my hair? They don't know me.
Important thing to you.
they don't know me, and most importantly, they don't know my hair. They don't know the intricacies of the waves, how it naturally wants to fall. They know none of that. They've got to learn that on the fly. And all of that creates uncertainty. The certainty that I built up over years of going to the same barber. I've had this my whole life. It's always baffled me. People who can just walk into a barber shop and be like, I'll just take the next available barber. Like, I get that if you're, if it's the first time you're going to, if it's like you've moved to a new place and like, I just need to try it some places till I find one that I it might be shit, but there's literally no other option. But if you go to your barber shop regularly and you just rock up, no appointment, and be like, I'll just take the next barber available. Crazy stuff. I've never understood it. I've always gone back to the same people. That is quite extreme. But whereas people just go like, yeah, I get my hair cut at this place, at this barber shop, but not by this specific barber. They just go to the barber shop, not the barber. Whereas no, I would follow, like, if my barber left, I would follow the barber. I wouldn't stay with the shop, if you know what I mean. But yeah, so this creates uncertainty. And like, it's obviously a fantastic, like, establishment, so like the hairdressers, barbers there will be all of really good quality. It's just unnecessary. I don't know if stress is the right word, but it's unsettling to know that now we're going to have to go through the whole ordeal about like explaining what you want for your hair, explaining what your hair is like, explaining what you struggle with, explaining what you like, what you don't like, what you're looking to avoid. All of these things that barbers just know over time. Your big reset button, big red reset button, back to square one. And you obviously have a much higher risk of just a bad haircut or a haircut that isn't what you actually wanted. Because, again, it's a new kind of relationship that you have in the form. And also, just as a neurodivergent person, I don't like meeting new people. I'm 35 years old, Patrick.
Yeah.
I have all the friends I need, arguably too many. I could whittle that list down if I really wanted to. I do not need to be speaking to more strangers. But yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously a great time for their business. And I'm three gritted teeth, I'm happy for him. But at the same time, I would prefer if he didn't, from a selfish perspective.
That's fair enough. Like, it is a huge palaver, and I feel like when you finally find a barber who is good, accessible, and affordable, it's so difficult to make a change to that. Like, I found a barber I loved, actually a Northern Irish guy, on Battersea Rise. There's a place called Project Barber, if anybody lives near there. And I started going there like a month after they opened, because they opened pretty much during COVID, like tail end of COVID. And I used to have to go to Clapham for supervision when I was training as a therapist. And I just saw them one day, went in, got talking to him, thought he was really legit, got a haircut from him. And I was like, holy shit, this is the best cut. And then there was a period I went through where I would actually go there on purpose, you know, like all the way there.
Yeah.
Just to get my haircut. But it's not practical. And eventually I found a place nearer me that costs quite a bit more. But when you factor in travel, it's about a wash. But it was a very tortured process. Like, I tried a bunch of places around near me and found it very stressful before eventually I found this one. And it's slightly more expensive than I'm comfortable with, but because I like every other element of it, I just tolerate it. But it was very hard making the transition. So yeah, I think that's a really good one. Okay, that wraps us over here on the public side. We will catch a bunch of you over on the paid side, where we'll be answering a question and we're talking about who we would like Arsenal and Manchester United to sign this summer. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you for listening. Please do send in your questions. If you'd like me to answer a question either on Twitter or here or on Instagram also, then you can donate to my fundraising campaign, my Just Giving. I'll put a link somewhere so that you can access it. But we really do appreciate you, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.